Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition. On our program today, with cases on the rise, why is Valley fever still being misdiagnosed? A heartbreaking story. And the controversial method of fracking, forcing oil from the ground, the impact it could have on our drinking water. Plus, the influence of Latinos on American popular music, where you can see an exhibit celebrating Latin music. But first, this year, diseases like West Nile and hantavirus have captured media headlines across the state and the nation. But close to home, there's another disease that has affected a far greater number of people and can sometimes even be deadly. It's called Valley Fever. While many believe the disease is just a fact of life for people living in the San Joaquin Valley, cases this year have spiked and some are calling it an epidemic. But outside the valley and parts of the Southwest, Valley Fever most often goes ignored, especially by those who fund research into treatments and a potential cure. As part of the reporting on Health Collaborative, reporter Rebecca Plevin tells us how this disease has changed the life of one Delano girl forever.
I'm one of my favorites.
Emily Garaspi cannot sit still.
This is called a transformation. We do it in hip-hop.
The spunky 8-year-old with long brown braids loves to make up dances in her bedroom.
We have to be straight with our hands. And we cannot lose our balance with our hands.
But last spring, when she was just 6, Emily became very tired and sick. She developed a fever that wouldn't go away, and red blotches appeared across her body.
She's got so much energy usually, and she just walking from one part of the house, like from her room to the living room or to the kitchen, she was drained.
That's Emily's mother, Valerie Garaspi. She knew something was wrong with her daughter when she became extremely fatigued.
It wasn't like a sleepy tired. It was like my body can't handle simple things like walking. She even lost color. Like her, she just looked pale to us. She just didn't look like our Emily, not just her actions, but just she just didn't look like herself.
Emily was eventually diagnosed with Valley Fever, becoming one of an estimated 150,000 people nationwide stricken with the disease every year. Valley fever is a fact of life in parts of California and Arizona. It starts with the simple act of breathing. Tiny fungal spores that live in the dirt enter the lungs. Everyone knows somebody who has had Valley fever, and most have survived. But in recent years, Valley fever numbers have soared so high that health experts are calling it an epidemic. Yet even as cases of Valley fever have increased, attention from policymakers and research dollars have not. In fact, just this summer, the small pool of funding for a potential vaccine dried up, leaving little hope of conquering the disease. Dr. George Rutherford is a Valley fever researcher at the University of California, San Francisco. He offered this explanation for why Valley fever research has long gone overlooked and underfunded.
Diseases that receive a lot of national interest tend to be diseases that occur in the East, where they read about them in the Washington Post every day, or CDC sees them in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution every day, or they make the New York Times. Diseases that don't exist in that belt really kind of fall off the radar screen. And unfortunately, Valley fever is one of those diseases.
But take a look at the numbers, and it appears that Valley fever should prompt a more aggressive public health response. For nearly two decades, statistics from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention show Valley fever doing more and more harm every year. Between 2000 and 2009, the rate of Valley fever more than quadrupled to 13 cases for every 100,000 people. That means that people in states that report the disease to the CDC had a higher likelihood of catching Valley fever than AIDS, hepatitis, or chickenpox. Dr. Michael McLean works in Ground Zero for this disease. He's the health officer in rural Kings County in California's Central Valley. He has watched as cases of valley fever have climbed in counties throughout the state. He doesn't know if the increase is due to better reporting of cases, improved diagnosis of the disease, or environmental factors. But the important thing is that in the areas where the disease is prevalent,
it'll always be here, we'll always have cases, and we should expect an ongoing burden of disease.
Here are the basics. People who work outside, like farm workers and construction workers, are most likely to get it. The disease hits blacks and Filipinos harder than the rest of the population, and people with compromised immune systems and older people are more likely to suffer complications. Most people feel nothing or experience symptoms similar to the flu or pneumonia. In a small percent of cases, the fungus spreads beyond the lungs. This is called disseminated valley fever, and the effects can be devastating. Doctors compare the illness to tuberculosis because of its ability to damage so many distinct areas of the body. The fungus can enter the bones, skin, and other organs, leading to brain swelling, lung failure, and eventually death.
My daughter was named Jacqueline Faith Hernandez. She was 14 and a half when she got sick real bad. We didn't know what was wrong with her.
That's Pascual Hernandez. His daughter, Jacqueline Faith Hernandez, came down with fever and chills and became very weak. The fungus had spread through her bloodstream, lungs, spine, and brain. She died in 2008.
It hurts to where you weren't able to see her walk across stage, to give her away to somebody in marriage. And because this disease is so crazy and outrageously ugly to where it tears people up.
Treatments usually include several rounds of antifungal medications and, at times, surgeries to remove infected bone or skin. If it is caught early, physicians have a better chance of keeping the disease at bay. But doctors don't often catch it early. Researchers say that most cases are misdiagnosed or missed entirely, in part because of a lack of training and attention in the medical community, and in part because the symptoms are so varied.
I think there are more cases out there than people realize. If you left someplace on the coast in Southern California and you drove up to Eureka and you stopped to fill with gas and whatever in Kings County, you may get contracted there. But if you go up to Eureka and you have a community-acquired pneumonia, chances are they aren't going to diagnose you with valley fever.
But many questions about the disease remain. No one knows how many spores need to be breathed in to contract the disease. And no one knows why some people die and others never know they are walking around with spores in their lungs. With more research funding, some of those could be answered, said Dr. McLean.
I think everybody who is involved in either in trying to prevent valley fever or treat it better or cure it or whatever issue you have around it, everybody, and I think can rightly say, we don't have the evidence that we would like to have, and the reason we don't is that there's no funding for it. If we can't raise awareness about it and raise the awareness of the significance of this illness, nothing will change.
Since 2000, NIH has directed nearly $600 million toward more than 1,200 projects involving West Nile virus. Valley fever projects have received about 4% of that amount, just $25 million over the past 12 years. The impact on human health is nearly the reverse. Valley fever has stricken about 4 times more people than West Nile virus, with thousands more going undiagnosed. It has killed many more people, too. Dr. Rutherford.
We worry a lot about diseases that are spreading into the U.S., for instance, dengue fever, or Chagas disease in southern Texas. I think just because a disease occurs regionally rather than in all 50 states doesn't mean it's any less a target for disease control efforts.
More than a year after she was diagnosed with valley fever, little Emily is feeling better.
And he let my energy out.
But the disease has left a spot on her lung and changed the course of her young life.
You know what? I think we have to go inside. There's a little bit of breeze. Yeah, which way is it blowing?
That's what I hate about breeze.
But if it's blowing this way from where the fields are, then we need to be inside. Because we're going to get the dust from the grape fields over there. Come inside. Come on.
At a town hall meeting on valley fever held this fall in Bakersfield, Emily told State Senator Michael Rubio about her frustrations with valley fever.
I don't understand why valley fever picked me. For a long time in the beginning, I was mad at Valley Fever for baking me.
She wore a ruffly pink dress and matching headband and clutched a handwritten speech.
The x-rays every month show me the spot is smaller. I want it to disappear so I can do things I used to do and love to do.
But while Emily's health is improving, people across California's Central Valley in the southwestern United States continue to suffer from Valley Fever. And that won't change until there's more awareness of the disease and more research dollars. For Valley Public Radio and the Reporting on Health Collaborative, I'm Rebecca Plevin.
The Valley Fever was a common fate to the farm workers here in the Golden State. And I miss Oklahoma, but I'll stay if I must and help make a living in the Tulare dust.
And that is why we are doing these series of reports of stories on Valley Fever, is really to make the public more aware of this sometimes fatal disease. Joining me now is the reporter Yacina Amaro. She is a healthcare reporter with the Merced Sun Star and has done a series of stories on Valley Fever. We also have Dr. Dee Lacey, infectious disease physician with Kaiser Permanente here in Fresno. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
You know, hearing the story of little Emily and some of the other stories that I've read, just chronicling, you know, just how difficult it is for some of these patients, young patients, who take years to diagnose, and by then their little bodies have been so affected with the disease that is very difficult. And what I'm trying to find out is why do we still have so much of this, with the fact that Valley Fever is a common illness here in the Valley, and it is still being misdiagnosed by so many doctors. Dr. Lacey?
As it was alluded to in the report, the presentation is not unlike upper respiratory tract infection. They come in, they have a cough, they have a fever, night sweats, maybe a headache, loss of appetite. So it can look like any other bronchitis, sinusitis, community-acquired pneumonia. Sometimes there are some clues that the doctor could pick up on that would lead them to think, oh, this could be Valley Fever, the fatigue going on, no response to antibacterial medicines. Sometimes there's some classic rashes or more arthritis than you typically see with a bronchitis or a pneumonia. But especially doctors outside of this area don't necessarily think of it. And as part of the reporter indicated, if somebody is passing through the valley and the wind is blowing and they breathe in some spores, they can, you know, never actually put a foot in one of the affected counties and yet develop Valley Fever pneumonia.
But as in some of these stories that I've read, some of these patients are ill for a very long time. What does it take to test for the illness? Is there a test that they can be given to see if they indeed have Valley Fever? And if there is, why not just, if you have someone with the symptoms that don't go away, just like any other illness when doctors are trying to rule it out, that they would not just test for this? Is it an expensive test, or what is the situation?
There are basically three different ways of making the diagnosis of Valley Fever infection. One is if they, for example, if somebody had a pneumonia and they washed the lungs doing a bronchoscopy and they sent that for fungal culture, they could grow the fungus out of the lungs. This is not done that often, but that is one way. If they did a biopsy of a lesion in bone or lung or lymph node and saw the Valley Fever fungus on that biopsy and they had stained it for fungus, that is a way to make the diagnosis. But the most common way we make the diagnosis is a blood test looking for the immune reaction to the Valley Fever fungus. And that test is positive in 50% of people within a week of onset of their symptoms, 90% by the end of the month. So it's a blood test looking for the immune reaction to valley fever.
Yesenia, in the stories that you have reported on, and you've done a number of stories, where did you find as far as why it would take so long for the patient to even be tested for the illness?
Right. One of the reasons is because there's a lack of awareness about the disease among the public, and not only among the public, but among the doctors, even those who practice in the Central Valley. Oftentimes the disease is confused for a pneumonia, and many doctors won't even bother to test for valley fever.
But if that patient remains sick, you would think if they keep coming back, as in the case of a story you did about a 10-year-old girl named Jaden, if she keeps coming back and she's still sick after a year, how long did it take them to diagnose her?
Sure. It took several months for doctors to finally diagnose Jaden Lugo, who contracted valley fever when she was only 2 months. And she actually was misdiagnosed twice and was finally diagnosed with valley fever when she was 1 year old. And by that time, valley fever had already spread to her brain. And now she has severe brain damage, uses a walker to get around, and will have to take antifungal drugs for the rest of her life. And that's why it's important for doctors to test for valley fever if they see that patients are not getting better with treatment.
Now, Dr. Lacey, I understand that Kaiser Permanente really is starting a training program to maybe train doctors to be able to spot this illness quicker, or just to educate them about valley fever altogether?
I'm actually not aware of that. We, in Northern California, Kaiser, we have the infectious disease chiefs meet, and we have online interactions, and we share cases. Our facility is the farthest south here in Fresno, is sort of felt to be the experts in valley fever. Although the expertise does spread up through the north, we certainly get cases referred down here from the Bay Area and Sacramento.
Do you think like an emphasis on training and education among doctors would help with this?
Certainly that can help. I know my colleague, Dr. Harold Lynn, did a study during his infectious disease fellowship here at UCSF Fresno, where he found the incidence of pneumonia coming to just the outpatient emergency department there was quite high, and if patients were started on antifungal medications as part of their what we call empiric, that is without evidence yet, without knowing what the diagnosis is, as part of their empiric antibiotics, they did better. So they would get antibacteria medicines as well as they would get antifungus medicines against the valley fever.
And right now I'd like to hear from our listeners. Valley fever is very prevalent here in the valley. If you grew up here, anywhere from, in the North Valley all the way down to Bakersfield, and may have experienced this illness or had relatives who may have experienced this illness, give us a call. We'd like to hear your stories. You can call us at 800-224-8989 or 559-275-8989, or you can email us at talk@kbpr.org. Again, that's 800-224-8989. We'd like to hear your stories and your experience with this illness that is so prevalent here in the Valley. Yesenia, you also did some reporting about the fact, we've talked about the fact that there is no vaccine, that there's still not enough research being done when it comes to this illness, even though how many people, I think you've reported, die from valley fever every year.
Right. A recent report in the November issue of the CDC Emerging Infection Diseases showed that more than 3,000 people die a year related to valley fever, because valley fever was a underlying or contributing cause. And so more people are dying from valley fever than initially thought. But there's just a lack of funding, a lack of support to continue to move the research forward, to develop better treatments and even a vaccine to prevent valley fever.
How do we change that?
I think we need to bring more attention to, you know, the government agencies and the public about the seriousness, about how severe this disease can be and how it can impact a person's life.
One of the things in this, one of the stories that that you did report on about why there's not enough research or vaccine, there have been starts and stops when it comes to research and money going into developing a vaccine.
Right. Yeah. In the 1980s, there was a vaccine that was tested in humans, but it created some adverse reactions, and participants dropped out of the clinical trials. But efforts again in 1997 started up again with a grant from the California Healthcare Foundation, and five scientists at five different universities, and they all took their own approach to develop a Valley Fever vaccine, but that vaccine has not been able to reach the public because there's not enough funding.
Let's hear from Maybell, from Fowler. Maybell?
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for calling in.
Thanks for taking my call. A few years ago, I had a brother-in-law that developed symptoms of, like, pneumonia, and he lost, like, 47 pounds in less than a month, and the doctor wasn't sure. They kept treating for pneumonia, and then he had outbreaks on his forehead that looked like chicken pox, so they thought maybe it was that. Well, I worked at community, and I knew the infectious specialist doctor there, and I was telling him about it, and that my brother-in-law was dying and we didn't know what to do, and he said, well, it's not pneumonia. He said, you need to make an appointment, have him come in right away. So we did this, and he diagnosed him with Valley Fever, and he was on a whole year regimen of the antifungal medication, and we almost lost him, but thank God, you know, they diagnosed it in time. And I also had a cousin that lived in the same area that developed Valley Fever that dissipated to her back. And she had a friend from Oregon that had visited her. And by the time they diagnosed her in Oregon, the other friend, she was so far gone, the doctors in Fresno tried to help out with calling and giving information for the doctors there to treat her. But it was too late for her. But my cousin and my brother-in-law, they survived.
Well, but your example is exactly what we've been talking about, a person coming through the valley and moving on and then contracting the illness and doctors in another area not being familiar with it. Mm-hmm. You know, after your experience with your relatives, what would you like to see? What do you think needs to be done?
I would like to see more awareness of this, and these doctors take classes or be informed, or, you know, if you reach a point where you're not sure what this is and it's being treated and it's not being, it doesn't respond to the medication you're using, look elsewhere, you know, because my brother-in-law had been sick for several weeks, and I mean, he was just wasting away, and I just mentioned this to this doctor. I said they're treating him. Now they think it's chicken pox. He said, well, you don't get pneumonia and then chicken pox. I think he said you get chicken pox and then you can develop pneumonia. And he said, so this is not chicken pox and it's not pneumonia. Have him come in immediately. And thank God he was aware of this and got him the right treatment right away. I really feel it would be so important for the doctors to be informed about this. You know, not just to keep treating it for something that they're not responding to, but look elsewhere and go to Valley Fever because it's so prominent in this area.
Exactly. Well, thank you, Maybell. Thanks for calling in and sharing your story with us.
Thank you for accepting my call.
Well, it's just like she said. And I was talking to Yesenia earlier, doctor, and telling her about my own experience. I was diagnosed with Valley Fever when I was four, and I was misdiagnosed. And so I look at that, and you know, 50-something years later, we're still misdiagnosing people. It doesn't seem like we've made that huge of a leap. And what is it going to take? I'd like to hear from the doctor and then you, Yacina, because you've reported on this so much.
Well, as Maybelle was saying, it will take more education. We know actually for situations where people won't necessarily remember things, if we can have order sets or decision support information that support doing the right thing, that is, you're admitting somebody to hospital for community-acquired pneumonia, and the order set says, you know, for given patients where patient lives, which with an electronic medical record it could potentially pull in, consider valley fever, you know, send off this test, and then you would have to say, no, I don't want to send that test to make it not get sent. That would give you, you know, because 50% when they're with symptoms within a week will have a positive blood test. Now, the blood test takes a week to come back, so it's not instantaneous. It's not like a flu test where we get them back within the same day or a strep test. But still, we would get the information much more quickly than if we don't consider the diagnosis and try to make it.
Do you think it would help? One of the things I've read about and I've thought about, you know, every year when it's flu season or when we had the outbreak of whooping cough, you know, the state health department put out a public service and awareness campaign.
Right.
What would it take? Do you think, you know, if the medical community got together and kind of put this forth to the state health department to start an awareness campaign to not only make the public more aware of it, but medical professionals aware of it. Why haven't we done something like that?
I can't really speak for public health, but I think that would be a reasonable thing to do. Part of the problem is that the cases are diagnosed throughout the year. So unlike flu, where there's really because the disease spreads person to person and the incubation period is only 1 to 3 days, you can really see a spike in disease activity. And you can, you know, they can track it by Google searches on flu. They can, as well as Sentinel Labs doing testing. So you really have, you can say, yes, we are here now and we're having an outbreak. The valley fever, because of the lag in the time to diagnosis, because people are being infected throughout the year, you see cases throughout the year. So it's a little different. There's not a particular spike in disease activity where you can say if somebody comes in at this time, you really have to be thinking about valley fever.
And, Yacina, because you did a report on just how difficult it is, you know, why the research, the effort for a vaccine sort of failed, and the fact that you were saying the pharmaceutical companies, from what I've read in your report, just, you know, it comes down, I guess, to research dollars and money.
Right. There's a great need for government agencies and other institutions to invest in valley fever, to develop better, you know, tests, to develop a vaccine, and to help prevent more severe cases of valley fever.
And Dr. Lacey, I know you're going to be leaving us shortly, but could you just help with some information as far as passing along to the public? Now, can you catch valley fever from another person? Is it contagious? I'm sure people would want to know that.
Sure. The valley fever grows in the dirt in the Central Valley, and so it's a free living fungus mold. It grows in the dirt, and then when it gets dry, it sporulates, sort of making fungus seeds, if you will, which are really, really tiny. And then the dirt is dug up with the building or just blows across the road, and people inhale it, and the spores germinate, if you will, in people's lungs. And then from the lungs, they can spread throughout the body. The form that's from the dirt, the form that's at room temperature, if you will, is the form that is contagious to people. Once it's inside of people at body temperature, it changes to another form that doesn't make those fungus seeds that are contagious to other people. So somebody could be, you know, coughing and having horrible, overwhelming pneumonia with valley fever, and they would not be contagious to another person, unlike tuberculosis, which is contagious person to person. So the environment is what is contagious for valley fever.
And we have read and reported on stories for people who were just driving through the valley and may have picked it up from spores in the dust. That can happen.
Absolutely. And there have been outbreaks associated with, like, Army recruits digging trenches or people coming for model airplane shows where they're running around and it's really dusty and everybody's enjoying being out in the field, and then they go back to their countries around the world and develop their infections.
And I have one other question for you, Doctor. Some of the symptoms that they talk about is very high fever, shortness of breath, fatigue, skin problems such as rashes and skin ulcers, and headache and sweats. How long, if you have any of these symptoms, how long when you have them, as far as thinking, okay, it's not a cold, it's not a pneumonia, before you really go to the doctor and really just kind of, and I think that's what patients have to do, they have to ask to be tested.
Right. Well, typically from the time they've been exposed to when they develop symptoms would be like 5 to 21 days. Now, if anybody is short of breath, they should probably be going to the doctor anyway, regardless of what's making them short of breath, unless they're somebody who, you know, has bad lung disease and is always a bit short of breath. But, you know, if you're having a runny nose and a sore throat and everybody around you is having the same thing, that's probably not valley fever. That's probably the flu or some kind of upper respiratory tract thing. But if you're having these flu-ish symptoms and they're going a week or longer, especially if you're developing the rashes of valley fever are rashes over joints, or they're these tender, swollen lumps on the front of people's shins. These are fairly classic findings of sort of the immune response to valley fever causing the skin problems. So, I mean, anybody who's quite ill should probably go to their doctor. Anyone whose symptoms are not getting better within about a week. Now, even with a cold, people will cough up to 14 days. That's common. But usually people who have viral infections like colds or flus, they may have high fevers for 4 or 5 days with the flu, but they should be getting better after that. So if things are persisting or continuing after that, it would be reasonable to say, you know, I in addition to thinking maybe I have a virus infection, what about could this be valley fever?
Okay. And thank you, Doctor. And Yucina, is there any kind of effort with public officials to really bring more awareness about this, work harder to try to get more funding dollars for research?
Well, we're not aware yet of any other efforts to bring more awareness for this disease, just aside from the training that Kaiser Permanente will be providing for doctors down in Bakersfield with Dr. Nathan Amin to help educate doctors about valley fever and when to suspect valley fever. But we definitely hope that, you know, public health officials will maybe develop campaigns or, you know, community events to help bring more awareness about valley fever.
That's exactly what it's going to take. And these series of reports, which have been so informative, and letting people who really aren't that much aware of the disease know more about it. But, you know, there's so many people here in the Valley who have been touched by it, whether it's them or a relative or someone else, as we heard from our caller, Maybelle from Fowler. I'd like to thank you both, Dr. Lacey with Kaiser Permanente and Yucina with the Merced Sun Star, for coming in and sharing your information with us about this sometimes fatal disease. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Kaiser Permanente Fresno.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. A report released yesterday by the International Energy Agency says that in the next 5 years, the U.S. will become the largest oil producer in the world, passing both Russia and Saudi Arabia. And while the country currently imports about 20% of its energy, by the year 2035, the agency predicts that the U.S. will be completely energy independent. New and improved production techniques are a big part of the fossil fuel boom. One technique known as hydraulic fracturing or fracking has become the focus of an intense debate between the energy industry and environmentalists, and it has prompted the state of California to take the first steps toward regulating the practice. Here in the Central Valley, home to the Monterey Shale Formation, which some call the largest oil reserve in the lower 48 states, the debate over fracking is just heating up. Capital Public Radio's Kathleen Masterson reports.
The term fracking started as industry shorthand for hydraulic fracturing, but the word has taken on a life of its own.
No fracking way!
The EPA recently announced it's going to conduct a new study on fracking.
Fracking. Hydraulic fracturing.
Hydrofracking. Because of a government loophole, fracking is exempt from the Federal Clean Water Act.
Drilling in one town may be damaging the water.
It is my property and I deserve to be able to frack if that's what I want to do.
It's not just in the news. Fracking has moved so far into pop culture awareness, it's even the subject of a Matt Damon movie coming out in a few months. Fracking involves blasting highly pressurized water, sand, and chemicals down wells, often more than a mile deep. That fractures a tight rock formation and forces natural gas and oil out. Much of the controversy has arisen because there are instances where fracking has contaminated groundwater, but how often it occurs and where is highly contested. That fight could be coming to California. While much of the fracking boom elsewhere has been about natural gas, in California it's about oil. In fact, the U.S. Energy Information Administration estimates that there's still 15 billion barrels of recoverable oil, mostly trapped in the impermeable, tight rock of California's Monterey Formation.
Now we're going after the source rock and fracking it ourselves.
That's geologist Jan Gillespie from California State University, Bakersfield. She says the industry has already tapped the most readily accessible oil, but
there's a lot left, because when we produce a field, normally we only take out about a third of it. Two-thirds is left behind. And if the price goes up, it becomes worth it.
Because of the growing national controversy over fracking, the industry doesn't want to talk about where and how much it's using the technique in California. So to take a look at fracking's potential impact on water, I traveled to another arid state in the throes of a fracking boom. Meet one of my tour guides, Jen Palazzolo of Erie, Colorado. She's showing me a newly drilled well next to her daughter's school.
I think if we park here and walk on this path, we can walk back by the well and not trespass.
Erie, Colorado is a small but growing town full of sprawling subdivisions, bike paths, and schools. It sits in a county with more than 18,000 active fracking wells.
So that is Red Hawk there. Can you unbuckle, bud? We're going to go walk. I know.
With her preschool-age son in tow, Palazzolo shows me the well next to Red Hawk Elementary School. It was drilled and fracked over the summer and now will be producing for the next few decades. Palazzolo says she's really worried about the kids' safety. There will be hundreds of truck trips driving near the playground and the organic garden.
You know, and for the life of the well, you'll always have them picking up the product. They'll pick up the produced water, which was full of toxic chemicals, so what is the risk of an accident or a spill right in front of the school? What would that mean?
Palazzolo is one of four moms spearheading the activist group Erie Rising that's demanding more information about fracking. She keeps busy juggling her part-time job as a pharmacist, taking care of two kids, and now she's become a part-time activist. Palazzolo drives me around town pointing out active wells hundreds of feet from churches, homes, and parks.
Here is another large one here. I would say if you added up all the wellheads, probably 30 or more wellheads in a 1 mile radius of the high school.
Palazzolo wants more answers about how the industry handles wastewater and its plans for responding to a spill. She says she doesn't feel better after attending a number of public meetings the industry has held in town.
That's the problem. They seem to put information out there that it's okay with no scientific data, research numbers to back it up.
The lingering question is, does fracking actually pose a risk to groundwater? Former Colorado geologist Jeff Thine says there's an inexpensive, easy way to tell if chemicals added to water for fracking are leaching into groundwater.
We put a tracer in the frack fluids. Tracers are widely used throughout the industry. There's no particularly onerous expense. There's no new knowledge. And this protects the producers.
Putting a chemical marker or tracer in the frack fluid would protect the producers, Thine says, because then they could unambiguously prove if water contamination came from frack fluids or from naturally occurring underground chemicals common in oil-rich areas. Thine has worked in the oil and gas industry for public universities and sits on an EPA advisory board studying fracking. He thinks fracking can be a useful extraction method with proper safeguards. But he's lost two different jobs for his outspoken opinion that more study is needed.
We're not providing the public with the tools they need to have confidence in our activity. When you keep going, oh, don't worry, we've got it under control, we did closed loop. Well, that's great. Do you have any data? Will you share that data with us?
But the industry says it's already doing enough to protect drinking water.
What we're about to do is run this casing here. And this is what we run in our surface. We've got a little over 850 feet of this casing. And this is what protects your aquifers.
That's Wes Harrison at an Encana Corporation drill site in Erie, Colorado, not far from Jen Palazzolo's home. He's prepping the well to be fracked.
And once we get that drilled, then we run this casing and then we cement it. And that protects any aquifers from any hydrocarbons trying to come up the hole.
The mix of frack chemicals and water that's injected into the well gets a lot of attention in the press. But when the water comes back up the well, it contains even more chemicals. And that's because it's also picked up natural chemicals and salts and sometimes radioactive elements from deep underground rock layers. So the cement seal around the well pipe is crucial. It's rare, but as Doug Hawk with Encana explains, cement casing failures can happen. He says Encana had a contamination incident on Colorado's West Slope back in 2004.
The cement that was going down around the casing failed, and we didn't realize it.
Hawk says they drilled into a pocket of naturally occurring benzene, which then came up the wellbore and went into a creek. Encana paid a roughly $370,000 fine. Colorado learned from this failure and changed its rules. The state now requires testing the cement integrity before companies can start fracking. But back in California, fracking efforts have been largely under the radar of the state. In fact, California doesn't track fracking at all. It doesn't know how many wells are being fracked, where they are, or how much water they're using. When wells are constructed properly, the overall risk of water contamination is low, says geologist Jan Gillespie, a professor at CSU Bakersfield who has worked for the oil industry. And she says much of the water table in the Central Valley is protected from contamination by thick layers of clay. But she does have some concerns about fracking in the Monterey Formation.
I think what I've always worried the most about is probably the integrity of old wellbores.
The San Joaquin Valley is full of old abandoned wells. Gillespie says decades ago, there was no requirement to officially seal the well, and industry left many uncapped. And if you start fracking in the middle of all this,
you're sending out a high-pressure fluid. Could it enter a poorly abandoned well and then move up that old wellbore into something else?
Much of the water in Kern County is not drinking quality, but she says there are places where the drinking water aquifers are vulnerable and would have to be carefully protected. Given the public uproar about fracking across the nation and the increasing attention to it in California, the state has started writing rules to govern fracking. A draft could be available for public comment sometime in the next few months. But the rulemaking process could take a while, and if oil prices go up, fracking in California could become more profitable. And that might mean an escalation of the fight that's already flaring in other corners of the country. I'm Kathleen Masterson.
Well, before last week, California voters had rejected every statewide tax measure since 2004. This election, they approved two of them. They also said yes to more than 70% of the local tax and bond measures on last week's ballot. But as Ben Adler reports from Sacramento, this may not be the start of a new trend.
The passage of Propositions 30 and 39 snapped a seven-measure winning streak for the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association. But President John Kupal says that doesn't mean the attitudes of California voters are changing when it comes to taxes.
As Mark Twain said, the reports of my death are greatly exaggerated. So the suggestion that the tax revolt is somehow dead or mortally wounded, I think, is greatly exaggerated.
Kupal credits several factors as helping Prop 30 across the finish line. Governor Jerry Brown's relentless sales pitch, the temporary nature of the tax increases, and an election with heavy Democratic voter turnout. He's not alone in drawing that conclusion. Democratic consultant Jason Kinney.
Any elected official that views this as opening up the floodgates for new revenue increases across the state is looking at this the wrong way.
Kinney says voters are fed up with California's persistent budget deficits. They typically don't trust the state to manage its money, but this time they're willing to give it a shot.
It's not a complete circle of trust. It's more trust but verify.
And both warn against any effort to overhaul California's landmark 1978 property tax measure, Proposition 13. Here's Kinney, then Kupal.
It's viewed as a third rail political issue, maybe the third rail political issue in California. You touch it, you get electrocuted, and you die.
You've got to be careful before touching the third rail. You've got to see if the third rail is still alive.
As for the 70% success rate of local tax and bond measures, Kinney and Kupal agree that's consistent with previous years. Voters simply have more faith in their local elected officials than they have in the state. At the state capitol, I'm Ben Adler.
Downtown Fresno's Fulton Mall has a different look this season as a new outdoor ice rink is earning rave reviews from residents of all ages. It's all part of an effort to breathe new life into one of the oldest parts of Fresno. Valley Public Radio's Joe Moore has this report.
Just a few days before downtown Fresno's newest winter attraction was set to open, Christy Gordon didn't think it would happen.
You know, on Wednesday, it was just so hot. It was just walking to the office, which is right by here, I thought, I don't know how they're going to be able to pull that off. I just really don't.
But after a delayed opening of one day, last Friday morning, the weather changed, and temperatures dropped into the 50s. Just the nudge from Mother Nature that organizers had hoped for. And downtown Fresno's Fulton Mall turned into an unlikely winter wonderland.
Yeah, I came today and looked out my window, and it was the morning, and there were several people, like, on the ice, and it was just crazy. It was kind of surreal.
And surreal might be just the right word. Ice skaters young and old filled the rink on Friday evening, which is located right at the door of the landmark Security Bank building. It's the latest project from the Downtown Fresno Partnership, a private group of downtown property owners who are attempting to revitalize the area.
Well, over a month ago, they started putting up a big metal platform. And then after that, they put some pipes on top of the platform. And then just recently, they started spraying water on those pipes. There's a big machine that pumps refrigerant through those pipes, and then the water on top freezes. So we had cold weather yesterday, so they were able to get ice.
That's Steve Skibby. He's a downtown ambassador for the partnership, sort of a roving concierge whose job is to help shoppers and visitors find their way around and answer any questions they might have about the neighborhood. Today he has what might be one of the best jobs in Fresno, introducing people to the rink, all while on skates himself.
Nobody believed that there was going to be real ice here. That was the big thing. They're like, there's no way. I mean, it's Fresno. There's no way to do this. And there is a way to do this, you know, and we're doing it. And I think they're doing it well.
Skibby says the ice rink is part of an effort to bring more people downtown by creating an attraction that isn't found elsewhere in the valley. Among those who made it out for the opening day of the rink were Christina Guerrero and Tio Martinez. The teenage couple stood near the center of the rink holding hands, not so much out of a romantic mood, but more to keep from falling.
Well, I actually saw the news this morning and it sounded really fun, so I came out here.
It's something I've never done before, and because she wanted to come, so I brought her. Or she brought me.
I don't really know how to ice skate, so that's why.
Is this your first time on ice
skate? My second time.
Any falls the first time?
Very. A lot.
And the skaters aren't the only ones who hope they don't fall. The ice rink is a major gamble for the partnership. Earlier this year, the group held a fundraiser in which participants paid for the privilege of rappelling off the top of the Security Bank building, in part to raise money for the rink. Sponsorship dollars from Community Hospital also helped make the event possible. But Elliot Balch, downtown revitalization manager for the city of Fresno, says that no city money is involved in the effort.
So no city money is going into this ice rink. This is not a city project, but it's definitely consistent and, you know, furthers the city's goal of revitalizing downtown Fresno. You know, it's come down to just really hundreds of thousands of dollars that it's taken to put this on coming from the property owners.
Several years ago, the owners of properties near the Fulton Mall voted to form something called a P-bid. It's something like a homeowners association, except instead of enforcing rules on what's in someone's driveway, the focus here is marketing downtown and attracting investment. Building owners pay an extra fee on their property tax bill each year, and that money is controlled by a board of property owners. Balch says the renaissance downtown is already underway. He points to the new wood-fired pizza restaurant that opened last week near the ice rink, the Fresno Brewing Company, and several other new businesses as examples of the rebirth. He says the ice rink is a family-friendly destination, which can also bring shoppers to those businesses.
You know, it's true. You can't find another outdoor ice rink this winter anywhere in the four-county area. So we have something unique here, and that's really important.
Back on the ice, Christy Gordon is skating backwards and turning with ease, while others are working hard just to stay upright. It's pretty clear it's not her first time on the ice.
I grew up on skates. My brother played hockey, and we all hung out in the ice rink. But I haven't been on skates in a very long time, so this is great. It brings me back to my childhood.
She offers this tip to veterans and newcomers alike.
Don't freak out as you're going down, because that, it really hurts a lot worse as you fall once you stiffen up. If you just kind of go with it and glide, it's a lot easier.
And Gordon says this first day of skating on the new ice rink downtown won't be her last.
Oh no, I have several lunches and breaks throughout the winter season, so I'm sure I'll be out here. It's great exercise, and it's fun.
For Valley Public Radio, I'm Joe Moore.
Well, I'll have to ask our Joe Moore if he strapped on his skates and see how he did. Sounded like a lot of fun. The downtown Fresno ice rink is open 7 days a week, now through January 13th, on the Fulton Mall at Mariposa. Stay tuned. In just a moment, we'll hear about a new exhibit from the Smithsonian that's making a stop in Fresno to honor the nation's Latino music legends. That's next on Valley Edition. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition. While there is no denying the influence of such music stars as Tito Puente, Carlos Santana, and Selena, the kind of impact they have had on American popular music, a traveling exhibit organized by the Smithsonian Institute is making its way to Fresno. It will be on display at Arte America starting on November 17th, and it sounds amazing. Joining us to tell us more about it is Frank Delgado, Program Director with Arte America. Thanks so much, Frank, for joining us this morning.
Thank you for the invitation.
You know, I read about this exhibit, and it just really, it sounds like a lot of fun. It sounds amazing. And it's called the American, I hope I am pronouncing this correctly, Sabor. Tell us, what does that mean, and what is it?
Well, the word sabor in Spanish, it means flavor. So the exhibit is based around the Latin flavor that has influenced U.S. popular music. So we're not necessarily talking about music that people will think of, Latino music, mariachi, et cetera. But it is U.S. popular music, as you mentioned, Santana, Celia Cruz, Richie Valens, and how Latinos have influenced the music in the United States from World War II to the current.
And it's been a huge influence. You are so right about that. Now, from what I've read, this is a multi-sensory sort of exhibit, so people get to interact with it?
Absolutely. In fact, that's what I'm doing here at the center right now. They have sent a registrar out from Washington, D.C., and we are assembling these huge pieces. There are panels. There's a dance floor that's part of the exhibit. There are listening stations. And it's all educational, a way for people to listen and view and learn from the experiencing the exhibit itself. And we also are programming various concerts to coincide with the exhibit that will give people even further learning experience.
That is amazing. Now, it's my understanding that this exhibit is traveling to only 12 cities. So
correct.
Fresno is really pretty lucky to get this.
Absolutely. We are very, very lucky. And the Smithsonian people, and it's funded by the Ford Motor Company Fund. They are funding its tour throughout the United States, and it will be here at Arte America. So it opens this Friday, but it'll be going till the middle of January. And this is a very this is a very key time for Arte Americas to really be able to show what it is that we're doing here and to be able to highlight the valley, because we've actually created a secondary exhibit which will go alongside this one that is Sabor del Valle, which really represents the musical, Latin musical influence here in the San Joaquin Valley.
And it's my understanding, excuse me, that it's going to be contributions going back from the 1940s to the present. So, I mean, just name some of the musicians people will have the opportunity to learn about and see their influence.
Well, you know, the what's great is that you have artists that are from the earlier days, like Tito Puente, like Machito, but you also get current artists like Santana, Selena, and also artists that are creating music that a lot of people would think indigenous to the United States would be rock and roll artists, hip-hop artists, rhythm and blues, jazz. So it's really salsa, all sorts of different styles all brought together, so it really connects with everybody who visits the exhibit.
It sure sounds like it. Again, you said you have a companion exhibit along
Correct.
With this.
Yeah, it's called Sabor del Valle, and Dr. Manuel Peña, who's an ethnomusicologist from here in Fresno, is one of the national experts on different types of Latino music. So he has done a series of interviews and done some research on local musicians that have influenced this area and have also influenced other musicians in other areas, but they've all come out of the Central Valley. And one other thing, Juanita, too, there are also, we have a huge Latin jazz concert that will be happening on Art Hop Night in December. There are a lot of local Latin jazz musicians that have gone on to New York City, San Diego, bigger places. We're bringing them back for a huge all-star show. So we're really also not only highlighting the Latin influence, but also the Valley.
This sounds absolutely fantastic. And I understand, too, there's also going to be, other than the music, and you've got a dance floor. This is amazing. You're going to have a lot of rare artifacts from this time period as well.
Yeah, we're going to be actually showing some of the original poster art. I believe we have some of Celia Cruz's shoes here as part of the exhibit, but there's also just lots and lots of mementos and different parts of these specific performances and these particular artists that really help people to connect with the content.
Now, it's going to start on the 17th. Is there going to be some kind of big opening that day or a big party?
Absolutely, and this is the big deal. So actually, I should probably even mention on the 16th, on the day before it opens, we're going to have a preview that is just for educators, K-12, college professors, and that is free. And they can come in and see that on the Friday before from 4 to 7. But on the Saturday, on the opening day, we're going to have dancing inside and outside. But the key thing is all of these concerts. There's a concert that's going to feature Malo, Tierra War, Tower of Power here at the Rainbow Ballroom. The only way to get those tickets is to come here to view the exhibit. You put your name in, and we draw a winner every hour. So that'll be this Saturday. People, if they want to go to those concerts, they're all free. But you have to come to the opening big celebration.
Wow, that sounds great. Thanks so much, Frank Delgado with Arte Americas, big exhibit coming up November 17th. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can also email us at talk@kvpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, and executive producer Joel Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.